In the studio with me is Doug Tarin, who is the curator of biology and vice president of research and conservation, Chicago Academy of Sciences and Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. I like to think of you as the butterfly guy, but there's probably a few other people who do as well, don't you think?
I have been called that before.
Have
yes.
you? Okay, so is it on your license plate? That's what I want to know.
It is not on my license plate, no.
Maybe it should be.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I can arrange it. Let's sit down. We'll figure this out. I mean, how many other people out there are going to call them? Of course, it's too many letters. You'd have to, you know, do one of those weird things where they contract the – I saw one of those the other day, and – it took me 35, 40, 50 seconds to figure out what it meant. And my feeling is you contract the letters so much that you've got people just guessing at what it is you mean, then there's no point in it, right?
You've kind of blown it, yeah.
Doug, you and I haven't sat down on the radio for a long, long time. It was back when I was at Gargantua Radio down the dial that we last did this. So I'm glad to have you back, and I've been thinking about doing this for a long time because, as you know, anybody who's paying half attention knows it's not just our butterflies, but our insects in general are kind of in trouble. We're not helping them a whole lot, are we?
There's been a lot of decline in a lot of species, and I of course pay most attention to the butterflies. In the last couple of years, in particular, have been kind of tough to see what's going on. Some of my favorite species have really crashed over the past few years.
All right, name a couple that if that's happened to, and you don't even have to say monarch, okay? But we know that's at the top of the list for a lot of people,
right? Well, the monarch, of course, is the one everybody is familiar with, but things like Baltimore checker spots and eyed browns, which are two lovely wetland butterflies, on a number of sites, particularly last year, somewhat the year before, they have simultaneously shown some unprecedented declines. On multiple places around the Chicago area, and we're not really quite sure exactly what's going on there.
Well, that's interesting, and I should point out that's your area of study. Your primary area of study is wetland butterflies, right?
Well, I've been a steward on a wetland since the early 1980s, and so I pay particular attention to wetland butterflies. But I also do a fair bit of work with prairie butterflies as well.
Oh, okay. All right. I would guess that wetland butterflies would be more in danger simply because we have a tendency to drain all of our wetlands and take them over, and that to some degree we're trying to restore prairies. Would that be inaccurate?
Well, prairie butterflies are doing at least as badly as
then I feel better. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just being a ray of sunshine here. But
you ought to show up next week when we're talking about the end of the world, okay?
But realistically, most of the butterflies that require these tiny, tiny remnants of native habitat that have been so badly reduced here in Illinois are all struggling to one degree or another.
And what are the various reasons that's the case?
Well, the vast majority of it is frank habitat loss. You know, when you've lost over 99.9% of the prairies, when you've lost over 90% of the wetlands, there just aren't that many places that these species require to live in remaining anymore. And so that's been a big problem. The other thing is the remaining pieces get kind of smaller and smaller and erode a bit around the edges. They become more vulnerable to floristic changes because they've become so small. And these things are also harmful to the butterflies. Insects tend to respond faster to these types of changes than plants do because, unlike most prairie and wetland plants, which are perennials, insects have to complete at least one round of their entire life cycle every year. And if plants have a bad year, they can not set seed for a year and, you know, they'll be relatively fine. They'll be able to bloom and set seed the following year. You can't do that with insects.
That's true. And you're echoing the sentiments of Doug Tallamy, who's written a book, Bringing Nature Home, and I've had on the program several times. And he's wanted all over the country people bring him in to speak because he has been talking about two of the things that you mentioned, and the first is habitat loss and biomass reduction in terms of our insects. And I read something, maybe it was something you wrote or somebody else did recently. No, I don't think it was you, but somebody was talking about butterflies and said, we're cool until people realize that they're insects, and then they get all wigged out about it. It's because people respond.
Even butterflies? People get wigged out about butterflies?
They do. Huh. I mean, isn't that strange? Yeah. Well, you know.
I remember as kids growing them, like on the back of our house, we had this north side of the house and it had like a little ridge and there were always cocoons out back and the whole back side of the house would be covered in them. And we would watch them waiting for them to do. Is it a hatching? Are they hatching?
Emerge.
Yeah. And it was so much fun because I remember, you know, at first the caterpillars would crawl up and then they would cocoon themselves. And it was so much fun as a kid. And I don't think my nieces and nephews do that. I haven't seen that.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I go into garden talks and I ask this question. I say, when is it that we decided that insects are creepy? Do you need that to graduate from high school? Because kids love insects, for the most part. And then adults are creeped out by them. So where's the disconnect? Where does it occur?
I think it occurs when they come in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you might be right about that.
I would say all the teenagers. Like my kids, my family are great with them until they become teenagers. And then there's some ew factor.
I think it's coolness.
I think last year I was picking up cicadas with my hands, and my nieces and nephews were like, oh, my God. You know, like freaking
I know.
Out. Okay, an ugly bug, but still.
But
cool.
But it's something about peer pressure, I think. I don't know. And it's not necessary really to do a study on it, but it is necessary to change the way we think about insects.
And I do wonder, though. I mean, this generation isn't necessarily outside gardening. They're not getting their hands dirty. They're not playing outside in the woods. I mean, when we were kids, we were, you know, the door was open in the morning. We were sent out and we were told there would be peanut butter sandwiches sitting on the picnic table around noon, but we weren't to come home until the sun went down.
Yeah.
If the streetlights were on, we would go out and play. And
yeah.
that's not what kids do today. Kids are, you know, I think people are afraid of the dangerous things that might, you know, I don't know. Kids just don't, they're not sent out with those kinds of parameters anymore.
And when they are sent out, they're sent out with a helmet and knee pads and elbow pads. Mm-hmm. And it's like, try to move, kid.
I do agree with helmets. I've had a concussion.
When you're looking for bugs?
No. When you're riding your bike.
Well, that's different. We're talking to Doug Tarrin, who was Dr. Doug Tarrin, I should say. You're rolling your eyes. It's okay, but I should mention it, shouldn't I? You're a PhD.
You worked hard for it. Absolutely.
That's right. From the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum. You were telling me as we came in today that there's a butterfly you're working on right now that you're doing. Tell me about this.
The butterfly we're working on right now is a prairie species called the regal fritillary. And this butterfly is just drop-dead gorgeous. It's about the size of a monarch. It's got some of the same orangey color that the monarch has, but it's got these beautiful blue-black hind wings. And it is in real trouble here in Illinois. It's down to just a couple of self-sustaining populations. It had populations here in the Chicago area up until probably the mid-1980s when the last of those winked out. And we have been trying to bring it back to the Indian boundary prairies down near Markham. And the way we do this is that we go out into the field to one of the remaining strong populations, collect a few females, get them to lay eggs in the laboratory, rear them up, and then release the adults to try to start a new population when they've grown up. It's a challenging species to work with because of the way they spend their winter. The females lay their eggs in September. The eggs hatch, the caterpillars eat the eggshells, and then immediately go into hibernation.
Mm.
And so you've got these tiny, tiny, just tremendously vulnerable, millimeter-long caterpillars spending the winter, and they need to experience the winter cold.
So you can't take them indoors and say, hey, don't worry, we'll take care of you, because that's the wrong thing to do.
It is. You could do that. And the result of doing that would be that you would have adult butterflies in February. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
So we have tried to devise ways of bringing them over the winter. Refrigerators are not terribly good to do this with because they dry things out terribly.
Mm-hmm.
So we have experimented with different types of wintering cages on the museum roof. And we've had some success, but our success is not as reproducible as we would like. So we've set up a more formal experiment this winter with statistical sampling and very defined parameters that we're testing. And tomorrow we're going to be hoping that we can wake at least some of these caterpillars up and start feeding them in the lab to get them ready to release later this spring.
And you've done that with also the swamp metal mark.
We've also worked in the laboratory with the swamp metal mark. We actually had our first field release of adult swamp metal marks just this past late August.
Yeah, I saw the article. You sent me an article, and I appreciate that. And I linked to it at MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, and when you're reading up about Doug Terran, you released, 20 of them, right, in Elgin?
Well, we released 20 on the day that the article was written.
Oh, okay.
Fortunately, we were able, over the course of the next week or so, to release more than that. All told, we released about 60, which is still a very small number. But
really, in the scheme of things, you think, how can that even have an impact at all?
Well, one of the nice things about working with insects is that females produce a very large number of eggs. So, for example, when you're working in the laboratory, you can really expand populations rapidly. In nature, only a small percentage of these survive. We're hopeful that the small numbers that we've released makes the limited number of targets for predators there such that they'll have a little better chance of reproducing on site and getting a population started. But, of course, it is such small numbers that we've been working with that we will be doing this again for at least one more year just to try to get the genetics up to something a bit more reasonable.
And then go back to the fen, which is Bluff Spring Fen in Elgin, and then search for the progeny of the ones you released?
Yes. We will be going out starting in the next couple of weeks and looking at the host plants to see if we can see any feeding damage. That's fairly easy to find with this species, and that way we won't have to wait until June or July to see if any adults have made it through. Of course, we'll be looking then, too.
And one of the things that fascinates me in reading up on it, your blog and the articles, is that you keep trying different stuff. You're learning every day about how to keep, you'll try one thing with an insect and then a bunch of them die. So, that's not working. Let's try something new and let's do this. And as you talk about, how do you help them over winter because they need the cold? That is a painstaking process, is it not?
It's actually, for me, the most exciting part about this is I'm not just following a recipe here, that there's a lot to be learned. This is an emerging field, and so that makes it very exciting. It makes it very rewarding when things do finally work. But to a large extent, we are making this up as we go along. We're, taking very careful records of things and keeping track of what works and what doesn't. We're trying to bring a more formal experimental approach to certain aspects of it. But you're entirely right. Keeping stuff over the winter is the hardest step in the whole process.
It's the same with plants, actually, because I've seen this before where somebody has a plant, it just gets started in the fall, and it's a plant that likes to overwinter, but they didn't get it into the ground. And they say, well, okay, what do I do with it now? Can I put it in my basement? Well, if it doesn't go into dormancy, that can be an issue. And then when you bring it out in the spring, that can be an issue too. And how many months can you sustain a plant that is craving dormancy and not getting it? How long can you do that? And I imagine it's the same thing with insects.
It is. And we actually have to do something similar with plants because just right around the first of the month, we had violets that we had potted up outside. That's the plant that the regal fritillary caterpillars eat.
Mm.
And so we had to bring them into the lab, get them to break dormancy and start growing so we'd have something to feed the caterpillars this week when we wake them up.
Let me ask you something. Violets, the same ones that people use herbicides on in their backyards? Or different kinds of violets?
In the wild, they use different species of violets.
Okay.
It's a combination of having the violet there and the vegetative structure that they need means that the species that people are killing in their backyards aren't what they're using in the wild. The good news for us is they can use that species in the laboratory, so that makes it a little bit easier for us to get plant material for them.
That is Doug Tarrin speaking. He is the butterfly guy, but it's not on his license plate yet. From Peggy Notabart Nature Museum, I want to let people know, we've got a few minutes if you want to ask a quick question about butterflies, 773-763-9278. Carrie is waiting, standing by to get your calls. The question I'm going to ask you now, you don't need to answer right now unless you've got it at the top of your head, because I did promote this as your State of the Butterflies presentation. If you had one word to describe the state of the butterflies, or two words or a phrase, what would it be? Now, you don't have to answer right now if you don't quite have it, but if you do, great. But otherwise, think about that until the end of the segment here, and okay. I will have you make that pronouncement. Let us talk about Monarch real quick. You've actually visited their overwintering grounds in Mexico.
Yes, I've actually been to two of the different reserves where the monarchs cluster in previous years, at least, in just the tens of millions in the Oymel fir trees there. And it's not only can one not imagine, it's really difficult to explain or express or convey to anybody just what it's like to be there. I put pictures up on my blog, and it just strikes me as totally inadequate every time I look at them.
I don't really have a bucket list, but if I had an actual bucket list that was written down, that would be on it, because I just can't imagine the beauty that it is and the delicacy. And I mean, I just see those images and it's breathtaking.
It is breathtaking, and it's one of the things that you get there and it lives up to expectations.
Because they're so magical. I don't know what it is about a butterfly that is just magical.
I don't know either, but it is. I mean, that's
yeah. The last time I was there, I was with a bunch of, you know, very formal scientists who work with the monarch from all over the country and all over Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you think that you're with all of these professionals who have seen it all and are used to it. And about 15 minutes after we got up to the part of the sanctuary, the monarchs, where they're actually roosting, I realized that everybody was whispering. And you don't need to. They can't
hear. Butterflies don't mind sound.
They don't mind sound, but it was.
Do butterflies have ears?
No.
So they
can't even hear.
They can't hear, but I imagine they feel vibration.
They can feel vibration, sure, very, very well. But it was like being in church. It really was. Uh-huh. It was
There's a reverence.
There was a reverence. You were witnessing this just magnificent natural phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I get goosebumps just thinking back to it.
I felt something similar in Costa Rica. I was in Monteverde, which is a sanctuary and a habitat there. And we were there kind of late in the fall, so there weren't a lot of butterflies there. Maybe I don't know what their periods are, but there was one that was sitting on my shoulder that was bigger than my hand. I had never seen, I don't remember what kind of a butterfly it was. My Spanish, that wasn't in my Spanish class, surprisingly, butter translation. It was remarkable. And yeah, we whispered the whole time we were there. Yeah. Granted, we were looking for sloths and we were looking for, lots of other things. And so you can't be a big, loud, clumsy oaf when you're stumbling around in the woods, but it was remarkable sitting in the, being out in a rainforest and having these land.
Here's the problem. At their peak, which it was apparently 1996, the monarchs occupied nearly 45 acres of land and their overwintering area. This past winter, it shrank. This is writing in the New York Times. This is an article in the New York Times that was published in December. The overwintering monarch shrank last month to a bare 1.65 acres, the equivalent of about 1 1/4 football fields. That's what's left of the monarch population.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. No, in fairness, 1996 was a remarkably
a
large
year.
Year.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If you look at the population data going back into the 1980s, 1996 sticks out like a sore thumb.
Okay.
It has also not been a steady, inexorable decline. These numbers tend to jump up and down from year to year.
But the last few years it has been.
The last few years have been
precipitous. Been
very bad, and I think precipitous is a reasonable word there. But it's easy to make things sound really alarming when, in fact, things are simply very alarming.
So on the gradient.
Oh, well, there we go.
I'll sleep well tonight.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take a quick phone call before we let you go. Let's go to the phones. And Catherine, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I love the subject. I love your show.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have a field in the back about approximately an acre. And I specifically put it out there for all the pollinators and the bees. But every fall, I cut it down. So hoping the seed would come down and it would improve the field every year. Am I taking away the eggs of the monarchs? I always thought the monarchs came out and then went to Mexico every fall.
Well, it might not be the monarchs, but I think Doug will have an opinion about this.
Well, first of all, you're not taking away the eggs of the monarchs because you're quite correct. They do go down to Mexico every fall, and none of their life stages are up here for the winter. If you are cutting the stuff down and not taking it away, that's probably not too much of a problem if it's just lying there on the ground because the eggs of things will just continue on as they would have. If you are actually clearing the vegetation and taking things away and putting them, say, in your compost pile or something like that, you may be removing immature stages from some of the insects that you might want to have around in the field.
No, I leave it sitting there because I'm hoping the seed will stay, and every year I'll keep improving on more milkweed and more milkweed and more wildflowers.
Well, then you're pretty much leaving what needs to be there. So that's good news.
What about all this burning that I see in all the fields around the areas and the forest preserves? Wouldn't burning then hurt it?
Burning's a really interesting question, and one of these things that's very much a double-edged sword. On one hand, prairies and a lot of the natural areas here around northern Illinois and over much of the country need to burn. It is part of what they require to be good, healthy ecosystems. There are guidelines that people use that allow them to burn in ways that will not damage butterfly populations. This is something that's actually been studied a fair bit. And as long as people are burning on a certain rotation, it seems to be compatible with good butterflies.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Catherine. Great questions. I appreciate it. And keep
Thanks,
up the good
Mike.
Work. We appreciate that, too.
Love you and your show. I learn a lot.
Oh, I appreciate that, too. I'm appreciating everything. All right. I'll talk to you later. Have a great Sunday.
Bye-bye.
Before I let you go, Doug, one of the things you mentioned to me, we had a little phone chat before the show, and it's about the loss of habitat and one of the reasons we're losing habitat. Talking about monarchs, they don't have milkweed anymore. I think it's unfortunate that it's called weed, milkweed. I think it should be called monarch plant, and we should change the name right now because, labeling and marketing, branding is everything. But as you pointed out to me, that's part of the problem is that we're losing it. What is going on?
Well, there have been some recent changes in agricultural practices that have appeared to reduce the amount of milkweed that's present here in the upper Midwest. Some of the new technologies around corn production have allowed much more extensive use of herbicides on the cornfields. The corn plants themselves are resistant to these herbicides.
So they can use them with impunity because it's not going to kill the corn plant, so let's throw some more herbicide out there.
And I don't think anybody really fully appreciated the degree to which monarchs might have been using milkweed inside of these agricultural fields. You know, people are aware of it on the edges of the ag fields and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the current hypothesis is that the decline may be linked to this reduction in milkweed on the interior of agricultural fields.
You mean within fields?
Within fields, yes.
Rather than in the rows, the hedgerows.
Right, actually growing in between the rows of corn.
Uh-huh. Oh, my goodness. And now, without getting into unsubstantiated theories, some people think it's the GMOs in the corn that might be causing some problems.
Well, it's the GMOs in corn are allowing this type of agricultural practice to be done. The GMOs in the corn aren't probably not, directly harming the monarchs themselves. They are allowing this change that is reducing their host plant.
All right, Doug, what do you advise people to do if they want to help, obviously, plant wildflowers, flowers that our butterflies love? What else can they do?
Well, there's a big push to have people include milkweed and plantings in their gardens and in their yards. And that's certainly, at the very least, not going to harm the monarchs. And if enough people do it, it may actually help to reverse some of this trend.
Unfortunately, the city of Chicago has been giving out tickets for milkweed and they have to change. It just has to change.
And this is something else that I think people can do is to really work to change that. Milkweed is not a weed. Milkweed, there are some beautiful garden varieties of it if you don't like the coarser look of common milkweed. And the nice thing is all of the species of milkweed are perfectly good host plants for the monarch.
Well, let's petition the city. Let's start at change.org.
There are people working on, change.org might not be a bad thing. I mean, Kathy Cummings, who has been on the show and, mm-hmm. Fighting this. You're nodding, so you know her. Yes, a lot of people know her. She's working very hard at this, and I am in contact with her. In fact, she's got a lawsuit that is wending its way through the legal system.
Yeah, we haven't gotten an update on that lately.
No, we need to do that, and we will.
I get her emails, but I haven't seen anything.
Doug Tarin, thank you so much for being here. And your word for the state of the butterflies is?
Mostly not bad. It's a few species that are in trouble. And I do think it's important to recognize that the majority of butterfly species are doing fine. Some of these specialized cases are in real trouble, but we don't want to lose them.
And we don't. So let's try harder. Thank you so much for being here. We have to do it again sooner than the last time.
Thanks a lot. It's been great.